Hello, fellow readers. Welcome to A Reader's Community. In today's episode, the last of the season, we're talking about writing crime. I'm your host, Fasi Collins. Before we get to the episode, I want to remind everyone about our live event that is taking place next week on the 9th of June at Cape Town office. It is a book club meeting, which will feature an opportunity to meet Joy Watson and to discuss her debut novel, The Other Me. If you'd like to buy a book before the meeting, you can get it at the book lounge at a 20% discount. Tickets are 50 Rand, but if you enter the discount code, you can get one for free. The discount code is ARC, and you can find the tickets on Quicket. Today's featured author is Rafiwa Maneta. His most recent book is a literary biography about his father, Captain Amos Maneta, who was a police officer and a detective before he retired. He was known as the top cop of Soweto. And this book is a mix of journalism, anecdotes, memoir, and philosophical reflections about Rafiwa's father, but also about crime and policing. The writing is beautiful, and it offers a valuable window into a difficult job, especially the toll of such constant brushes with violence and death, not just for Rafiwa's father, but for the rest of the family as well. Later in the episode, I'll be joined by Mervyn Sloman, the owner of the Book Lounge, to give us some recommendations about crime writing broadly construed. And in that conversation, we'll delve into detective fiction, true crime, and other recent literature. Here's my conversation with Rafiwa about his book, A Man, a Fire, a Corpse. Hi, Rafiwa, and welcome to A Reader's Community.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with you telling me a little bit about yourself.
Cool. So my name's Rafiwa, just Raf for short, Johannesburg-based writer, photographer. How I started publishing was I usually used to self-publish quite a few books. My most recent one got picked up by my publisher, Blackbird Books, when they saw me tweeting about writing it in its very early stages. So yeah, in a sentence, that's just me, Johannesburg-based writer, photographer, and someone who used to self-publish a ton.
So today we're talking about your new book, which is published by Blackbird,
right?
A Man, a Fire, a Corpse. And this is the story of your father's life as a police officer. And it's quite fragmentary or episodic. It gives sort of snapshots of his career, of him as a man, and also of policing in general.
Yeah.
Early on in this book, you draw a distinction between the facts and the truth.
Right.
It's a recurring theme throughout the book. And also kind of marks a distinction between you and your father, insofar as your father's a police officer and you're a writer, and where facts is the purview of the detective, the truth might be in more the purview of the writer.
Right.
Can you explain that distinction, and how does that distinction shape what kind of book this ends up being?
Well, so I mean, initially when I proposed the book to my father, both me and him were initially on the same page. It was meant to be a biography, like, as you say, just the facts, you know. My father started as a detective in 1986. In 1991, he became like a constable and so on. So it was meant to be just like a factual, straight up reportage.
Mm.
But, you know, as I was writing the book, I stumbled upon a book called The Invention of Solitude by Paul Auster. And he was also writing about his father. And I found it very interesting because, you know, essentially he discarded the idea of writing objectively about his father.
Mm.
Because of their relationship, there was no way, you know, he could write the book objectively like a journalist. So I was reading that, and then I was just fascinated between the distinction, because at some point my dad made that example. He said, facts solve the case, not the truth.
Mm.
And I think I make an example in the book where he says, someone, you know, a hijacking might occur and a witness might say car was black when it was actually navy blue. They'd be telling the truth, but it wouldn't be factual. And just as a son, like, I just found that, like, really interesting.
Mm.
The facts of his career, the fact that, you know, he, you know, might have solved, like, X amount of murders, you know, all of that was interesting in and of itself.
Yeah.
But I wanted to find out, like, how does someone who sort of, like, chronically and on a day-to-day basis engages with death and assault, like, what do they need internally to wake up in the morning and decide they're going to go to a job where, in all likeliness, someone might have been murdered,
yeah,
family might have been taken out by gunfire. And so I found, like, just giving a factual account, as in I came to the scene, I took a statement, that would have done nothing for his story.
Mm.
But I was also talking about him as a father, you know, as a human being and just going through rote, boring facts, I don't think would have done his story any justice.
I think it's a question, the distinction between truth and facts, it's a question that's at the heart of definitely memoir writing, but also biographical writing.
Right.
And it's, I mean, I guess one could argue that objectivity is always kind of a myth when you get really,
right,
because one gets attached to one subject matter, even if you don't know them personally, I would imagine. But when it's your father, I mean, that's just definitely true. It does seem difficult to be objective. I think it's such an interesting project to write about your father. I think it must be really complex and a very unusual process. So why did you want to tell your father's story?
One, I think just detectives as a whole. So I started writing around 13, became a journalist around 21. Mm-hmm. But detectives have always fascinated me as a subject. Honest detectives, as you are, just because you kind of have this cluster of people who sort of assign themselves as the people who sort of stop the barbarians at the gate. But then we also have like an interesting history with the police service as a whole, as in how the apartheid police force became a police service. And I was interested because my father sort of ticked all of those boxes, was trained under apartheid, you know, went from being trained under the police force to going to the police service. I just wanted to know how that was like, number one. But yeah, number two, I just think my father's story as a whole. So he's someone who'd, you know, for the entire 30 years, like he was a detective, 30 plus years, excuse me, he'd never used the word trauma at any point. That word only came up like towards the end of the 2 years I was interviewing him. And I was interested in that. You know, how do you, you know, so for example, there's a case we speak about where a 14-year-old girl was sexually assaulted and murdered. I was old enough to remember him working that case. And on one level, it was like very dispassionate, like sort of how a paramedic might go to a scene, try and revive someone. But then on another level, like he was going to sleep at like 2 a.m. trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together, trying to solve the murder itself. He arrested the suspects himself. And so I wanted to work through those contradictions. It just seemed like a fascinating thing to write about.
Yeah, it is really interesting. It seems to require so much compartmentalization.
Right.
The way that you portray your father, on the one hand, he's completely devoted to his job. He's completely devoted to justice, but also completely devoted to his family.
Yeah.
And that doesn't come easy. There must be costs involved in maintaining those competing devotions.
Of course. I mean, and I do think if I were to write the book again, I think I would have expanded on this a bit more. So I interview my mother towards the end of the book, and she's a police official as well. But to your point, to that point you make, like he could only become the kind of detective he was because of the kind of mother we had. I think I mentioned early on in the book that I think I referred to him as a ghost. I think from the time I was like 7 to the time I was 13, a very significant period of my childhood, you'd only see him in the morning, sometimes not even. He'd leave when we were asleep and he'd come back when we were asleep again, just because he was working some other case. Mm. And so, you know, in the beginning, like in childhood, I think he could only become the kind of detective he was because of my mother, because she was all too happy to say, okay, you can go off and be a detective. I'll look after the children.
And also it seems that she also protected you from the fear that you would have if you knew exactly how dangerous his job was and that there were people literally who had hits on him.
Yes.
And trying to kill him. And I think they should say something like, only, you know, now that he's retired, we can talk about it frankly. But it seems that you were very much protected from that information when you were younger.
Yeah. And I mean, how she describes it is, she says, you know, it felt like for 32 years of her life, the 32 years my dad was in the police, you know, service, she said it felt like she was holding her breath, like for 32 years, because she never really knew. She said she'd come to terms with the fact that, you know, he could have left at any morning and just never came back. And because they wanted to give us some semblance of a normal childhood, they just never really say. I think there's a passage early on where someone walks into the house and they say they're looking for my father. And then when we told our father who was looking for him, there was a complete sort of like an utter meltdown. We suddenly got cameras, the walls in the house got higher, told to lock the gate at all times. And I think that's the only time I got a sense that, something's a bit off here. But other than that, I think they tried their best to sort of like shield us from that.
What was it like interviewing firstly interviewing your dad, but then also interviewing your mom?
It was weird. It was really, really weird. So on one hand, I'm trying to interview him as a journalist. Like, so I'm asking him like really probing questions. So stuff like, have you ever had to shoot someone? And really personal stuff like, I don't know, like when, because my dad's quite like reserved, like he's held off. Like initially, he'd give me monosyllabic answers like, how did you feel when you got to the scene? I was fine. Okay, cool, but someone was murdered. What did you mean you were fine? So I think a bit of that, to be quite frank, irritated him a bit because I was trying to get him to open up and he's just not that kind of a person.
Yeah.
But also I think, you know, interviewing the both of them was, I think my father towards the end of the book said, and this was astounding, the last interview we had, he said, thank you. You know, sort of as a journalist, you ask anyone, do you have any other questions? You know, that's it from me. Anything else I might have forgotten? He was like, yeah, let's maybe talk about why you want to write this book and like why you asked me the type of questions you asked me. And then I explained, you know, I wanted to find out about your career, number one, but I also wanted to work you out. You're a very strange person. You know what I mean? You're devoted to this like 100%. But, you know, this was a significant part of your life. And for the most part, you never spoke to us about your career. So I was trying to figure that out. And towards the end, he just said, thank you. And I was like, okay, what are you thanking me for? Said, I've been in the police force more than 30 years. No one's ever asked me how I felt when I was working a case. He said, you know, I've seen people being murdered. I've seen people's limbs being severed. No one bothered to ask me how that made me feel internally. And he said that's where the initial awkwardness came from. He didn't know how to answer that question because no one had ever bothered to ask him. So in that sense, I think it was very relieving to him say that, to see him sort of break character, as in from the macho, sort of like grim detective, and sort of be human for a second. Mm. And my mother as well. I mean, the book is primarily about my father. Well, it is about my father. Even the accolades he got as a detective, you know, press, the media coverage. But I think no one spoke about the fact that, you know, for my father to be the kind of detective he was only because, you know, he could go off at like essentially at 3 a.m. in the morning knowing that someone was taking care of his kids. Right. So I think my mother also appreciated being acknowledged as well.
So what does your dad think about this book? Has he read it?
He has. He loves it. One, he thinks it's a faithful account of his career. But I was really concerned about the style. I thought that might throw him off a bit because, you know, I'll talk about his career and then I'll go off on a tangent a bit and talk about, you know, maybe True Detective or Truman Capote in Cold Blood. But he appreciated it because he read it and he said, these things like in and of themselves, like seem like, you know, this seems like a book that was written in the US, a series that was written in the US, a murder that happened so and so. But the fact that, you know, you're able to connect all of this back to my career shows that I wasn't just sort of like working in isolation. All of these things are connected. So yeah, he really loves the book. If anything, he just said, because I think I made mention of it in the book itself. So my father was never, despite like his conviction rate and all of that, he was never really a high ranking police officer. He was a captain. And so he said now, even though he's retired, at least this is an account of his career. And, you know, someone who might not have known who he was can pick up the book and, you know, all of a sudden there's a faithful account of his work as a police official.
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful tribute to him. And I also think it's interesting, the good cop being a nuisance. I think that's how you referred to it at some point. You sort of hint at why he wasn't recognized in the way he should have been. I mean, the evidence is there of his outstanding career. I mean, there were so many press cuttings and he was on the radio. Like he was sort of acknowledged in that way, but never formally with commendations or with ranks. So why do you think that is?
I don't know. I just think, just generally speaking, like from the bottom up, I mean, if you just have a look at our police service, it's insane that you have a look at someone like Jackie Slebe, who was essentially like the head of our police, was the head of Interpol at some point, was convicted and charged with like very serious like corruption charges. And that goes like way down to the bottom. Like you have a look at a constable who might look a docket that goes missing. So just generally speaking, I think police officials in this country like are paid terribly. The volume of documents is insane. So there's no incentive to be an honest police official. So they cut corners for the most part. Yeah. And when you can make a supplementary income, like cutting corners, losing a docket, it's obviously quite irritating when you have, you know, the guy who's in the office next to you repeatedly telling you, if you do that again, I'm going to arrest you. So, yeah, I think that might have been part of it.
I was thinking when reading this book, so a lot of the portrayals of police officers, I mean, especially South African police officers, there's a lot of stories of corruption. Like those are the stories that one encounters. And there are obviously a lot of problems with SAPS. But the story you tell of your father is of a man with unshakable integrity. And like I said, complete devotion to his job and justice, but also quite boundaried in that devotion to justice.
Yeah.
You know that trope in crime fiction where there's always the detective that goes rogue and then like breaks the rules to solve the crime? That doesn't seem to be your dad. Like, he seems to have been very, very clear about his role in investigations and getting convictions rather than becoming a vigilante, etc. Were you trying to counteract that narrative that is prevalent in media about the corrupt police officer?
Not necessarily. If I was, it was incidental. I think to that point about him being very boundaried, you know, religion is kind of like a secondary or tertiary, you know, theme in the book itself.
Yeah.
He himself is a very like religious person. So I think that kind of like helped because he had like a moral code that extended outside of being a police official. I mean, if when you read the book, you know, he says he only became a police official because he heard the voice of God whispering him and telling him to be a police official. You know, I'm not a religious person at all. Whether you believe that to be true or not, I think is inconsequential. But I think he sort of stumbled into the kind of job he did because he had like a certain set of ethics. So he says he wanted to be a doctor. You know, to be quite honest, I think he was always either going to be a police official, or maybe if he had the money like to study, he would have been a lawyer. I think he's always had kind of like this weird preoccupation with justice, however that may look. So yeah, I don't think I was, you know, intentionally setting out to sort of dispel any particular narrative. I just think because of the type of person he was and his particular set of ethics, religious convictions lended themselves to the job he eventually worked.
Yeah. In this book, you also think about policing and cite some academic studies about policing and books and also public ideas about policing. I'm thinking about also like Black Lives Matter protests, and those, you know, how police violence and those narratives filtering down to South Africa and also being relevant here. And balancing that tension between knowing that it's an institution with so many problems and yet also knowing a good cop. And I think you make those two interact in interesting ways in the book. I think it's difficult to hold both truths in your mind. So could you tell me how did you do that in the book and how do you do it in life and on this subject?
No, I think that's the one thing I've been always honest about. I think I danced around the subject like quite a bit. Initially, like the first draft of the book, I did speak about abolition quite a bit. What I honestly think about like police officials just as an institution. I mean, you call it interesting. I do think in some respects I did sort of cozy over the subject quite a bit. I had some very tough conversations with my father because he's always been of the opinion that, you know, don't look at police officials as an institution. You know, they're made up of individuals.
Yeah.
For me, on one end, as a Black man, whenever I'm walking down a particular suburb and a police official stops me and just wants to search me for no other reason that, you know, I happen to read as a criminal to him, it's because of a particular history and the fact that the state has outsourced their violence to that police official. He can essentially stop me, you know, because the state has endowed him with that power. And so even police officials just so happen to be individuals. There's a lot of institutional power that they carry with them and the history, you know, that's associated with that, with those institutions. At the end of the day, I just decided, you know, I wanted to write a book about my father and zone in on him. That's why, you know, the tension kind of came up like a bit more, like in earlier drafts of the book. I don't know, like how I sort of like convinced myself, like the cop out that I gave myself was, this isn't a book about police. It's a book about, you know, my father who so happens to be a police official. So yeah, I mean, I tried to talk through the tension, but I'll be the first to admit I cozied over it quite a bit. There's a lot I left out of that book.
I think the tension is evident in the book, but it is true. I mean, I think you point out the tension, you leave the tension with the reader to also sit with it and figure out what to do with it. But it's very interesting that that was included in the first draft, but it would have been a very different kind of book. You're right. And I mean, there are other books that critique the institution of policing that were even recently published, like Xander Steedman's Can We Be Safe? The books exist. Yeah. So I wanted to ask about true crime. In telling the story of your father, you also go into some detail about the cases that he solved, which ends up being kind of true crime writing. Yeah. You're recounting these events that really happened. In the book, you mention Truman Capote, who revolutionized true crime, and kind of turning on that fact and truth distinction where Capote sacrificed the facts in favor of the truth, but maybe even in favor of something that is not the truth. You also mentioned in the book that your copy of In Cold Blood it sounds ruined. What lessons did you learn from that book in how to write true crime or how not to write true crime in this book?
like you said, I don't think you can speak about true crime without speaking about that book. Seminal text. Yeah. I think before that, no one took true crime seriously. I think he was the first person to kind of give it like a literary flourish. The idea that the writing should be beautiful, you know, kind of like to have it be sort of like a nonfiction novel. But anyone who kind of reads the book, I mean, at some points, you do kind of get the idea that, and I just want to be careful with what I'm saying, but yeah, you do kind of get the idea that you might be reading a forgery here.
Yeah.
So he says things, for example, like cites some conversation and he goes into some level of detail and you read it and you think there's absolutely no way he could have known how this happened or to the level of detail he did. And then you go into like the backstory and you find out he didn't record a single thing. You know, he was just had conversation with people. So in my own book, when I was reconstructing scenes, and I'm not saying Truman Capote didn't do this in his own sort of like circumspect way.
Yeah.
You know, I'd never say, you know, a wall was peach without, you know, sort of like having evidence of that fact.
Yeah.
You know, I combed through witness statements, went to particular scenes, went through some of my father's very large gallery of pictures, crime scenes, the day was there. So, you know, I did my best to kind of like give an honest account of what happened.
Mm.
And even when, for example, the question came up recently when I was talking about Linda, the actress.
Yes.
There's a particular scene my editor was asking me about. And you can tell it's conjecture. I mean, I even start the scene with saying, I can't remember the exact words I said, but like, imagine what Linda would have seen. And I was very cognizant of the fact that I didn't want to embellish anything. So anything that was recreated, any scenes, there was either, you know, a crime scene photo that could kind of corroborate what I said, a witness statement. Capote himself was never a journalist. He was a novelist who went and wanted to write a true crime book. Whereas, you know, with me, it's almost the opposite. I'm a journalist, was trying to write something like very literary. And so, you know, even though I'm talking about scenes and I try to make the language as beautiful as possible, I was always careful not to get too carried away with the language. At some point, I think I might even publish, like, you know, just on my website, a few of the first drafts of what I actually wrote, because they're quite different. I think in the first draft, you see me like get carried away, like with the descriptions, with the recounting. And, you know, my editor was like,
yeah,
okay, cool. There's no way you could have known this happened. Yeah, let's leave this out.
Right. That's interesting. So, yeah, there was some reining in of the literary in favor of directness and simplicity.
Yeah.
What was it like writing these, knowing that your dad had been there and seen it and solved the case and known the suspects and all of that?
It was jarring. Like, it was a very weird experience. The first case we spoke about was that case with the actress and the baby.
Yeah. So this is an actress who killed her own baby when she was in a psychotic state, right?
Yes. Just for context. Yeah, you're right. And so initially when I was talking to my father about it, I said, okay, what happened? And because he had essentially gone to these cases with a very clear detachment, dispassionate, he was just recounting, I don't want to be too gratuitous, but we got there and XYZ happened and he'd spell the detail out like to the T. And when I was writing that out, you know, it was just weird that I'd speak to him and he was kind of going through each of the injuries and, you know, the body parts and whatever, as if he was talking about a grocery list. I think that's what essentially shaped, you know, what I'd go on to ask him. Because all of it's in the public domain. So these cases aren't too hard to find. If you Google my father's name, you'll find the cases. I think that's what inspired all of the other stuff, like going on a tangent, like I'm trying to find out what his pain scale was, for example, and the psychology that goes into detective work.
Yeah.
Because he was quite clear early on. And I think I mentioned this in a previous interview. I was probing him. I was like, how did the case make you feel? And I was like, I was fine. I was like, no, but how did it make you feel? And I was like, I was fine. So, and then he eventually said, look, dude, I see what you're trying to do. I was okay. Like, you know, I was a detective. I was fine with it. And that's what inspired all of the other interrogations that went into writing the book.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's also interesting. Obviously, these were things that were kept from you when you were a child, for obvious reasons. And then seeing what was actually going on as an adult. I don't know. Do you feel like it filled in bits of your childhood for you? Or does it feel like it was his life and not yours?
No, it definitely filled in bits of me and my siblings' childhood. So I think I mentioned in the book as well, my mother and father were extremely overprotective. We had to be back home by a certain time. And when I was a kid, I didn't understand why he was so preoccupied like with all of these what seemed like silly rituals at ensuring our safety. Keep the gate locked at all times. When you leave the house, text me. When you come back, text me. Whenever he'd take us to school and he'd sort of take his car out of the driveway, he'd sort of scan the street to see who was in the street, if there was anyone he had to keep an eye out for. So all of these things, you know, that kind of seemed like weird idiosyncrasies just kind of made sense. It's like, oh, okay, cool. You might have been scanning the street because you knew someone was out to get you. There was a hit out on you. You always wanted us to have the gate lockers, even though that's not the best form of security. At least there's a barrier that someone has to go through if they want to see you. So it just put everything into perspective. And I don't know, it just made me a bit more forgiving about my father, because I used to think he was quite harsh as a kid. But once I spoke to him about the detail of his police work, everything just sort of made sense. And so retrospectively, I was able to say, okay, cool, I understand, I get it. I know why you were the kind of person you were when I was a kid.
As a reader, it also, it's in the prologue that you illustrate some of his, I mean, someone else might call it paranoia, but if they were not a police officer, but it is totally, to contextualize, it makes perfect sense to the reader as well. I just have one more question, which is a personal question. You are also a father, right?
Yeah.
Did you learn anything about yourself as a father in this exploration of your father?
What a lovely question. Like, no one's ever asked me that. Yeah, I mean, I think if anything, it's just maybe not so much myself as a father. I don't know whether I mentioned this in the book itself, but I have sort of inherited some of my father's fears, you know, for my son.
Yeah.
So I just see, like, whenever he's not with me, like, I worry about him, like, quite a bit. And I think I think having written the book, it explained, you know, why some of how I parented. He's quite young. He's 5 years old. But I have been, you know, called a helicopter parent more than once or twice. He'll be playing and he'll scrape his knee, and then he'll be riding his bike and I'll keep telling him to be careful. So I think part of that is like inheriting some of my father's paranoia, for lack of a better word. But I did have a think about it. And I do think, you know, I'm maybe overprotective, but I do think I definitely do worry about my son quite a bit. And, you know, maybe that's just also comes with just being a parent in general. But having written the book, and having just thought about how I was raised, the type of father I had, I do think I've inherited some of his fears. And so I'm just trying not to hover over my kid like every 2 seconds. I do want him to have a childhood that's unencumbered by some of the stuff I had to deal with as a kid.
I'm sure you absorb some of his values as well.
Yeah, I mean, just generally speaking, I think I say towards the end of the book that I hope my son inherits my father's courage. Very courageous man, very honest person. So I think everything that was good and proper about my father, I'd want my son to inherit. Just a dedication to the truth, for no other reason than the truth deserves to be told. Be an honest individual, be a family man, and just a commitment to other people. At the end of the day, you know, I don't think I put this in the book. I like the term police service instead of police force, because I think service kind of looks at the police as sort of community care.
Right.
So the idea that you're not just, you know, going out and looking to arrest people and huddle them into the back of a van. But the idea that, you know, justice doesn't always have to be reactive, but the idea that the police function are like of social work. Yeah. So police officials who stop society's rot before, you know, someone lands into jail. So I don't know. Those are some of the things I think about when I even look at how my father, you know, conducted his own police work. And I hope, you know, my son inherits, you know, all of those virtues himself.
I've just realized that we haven't said your father's name actually once yet. He is Captain Amos Manetta, right?
Yes.
If people want to Google him and read some of the cases.
Yeah, Captain Amos Manetta, now retired.
Okay, thank you so much, Rafira. I've loved talking to you. I think it's a really interesting project. It's an interesting thing to take on, and you executed it in a really interesting way that is literary and conceptual, and I really enjoyed reading it, so thank you.
No, thank you so much. Like, this was such a lovely interview. I really appreciate it.
You can find A Man, A Fire, A Corpse at the Book Lounge. And if you're not in Cape Town, please do support your local indie bookstore. Speaking of indie bookstores, I sat down with Mervyn Sloman to give me some recommendations about crime writing. Not only is he the owner of the Book Lounge, he's also an extremely well-read person and a fan of crime fiction. So here's our conversation. Hi, Mervyn. Welcome back to the podcast.
Hello, Festy.
As you know, the featured author in today's episode is Rafiwa Maneta, who wrote A Man, A Fire, A Corpse, which is an interesting book. It's a kind of literary memoir slash biography about his father, so adventures into true crime territory as he goes through some of the cases that his father investigated. But it also kind of flirts with detective fiction tropes. Like, he draws on some fictional detectives as well. So I thought it was a good opportunity to talk about crime writing, broadly speaking, not just detective novels and not just true crime writing. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we might have in common that when we venture into genre fiction, we tend to venture into crime fiction. Is that true?
No comment. I do read a fair amount of crime fiction. That would be fair.
Okay. So I thought you'd be the perfect person to give us some recommendations. So let's hear the first book.
The first book I want to mention is something that's been around for quite some time, and that is Sifiso Mzobe's debut novel, Young Blood, which won the Sunday Times Fiction Award when it came out, which was extremely unusual for a crime novel, but I think it is testament to the quality of the novel and the impact it had in South Africa. It's set in KZN, in the townships there, where Sifiso grew up and areas that he knows really well. And the central characters are carjackers, if that's the correct word, people who hijack cars. And what the novel did, I think, extremely well was to create a sense of these people who were perpetrating crimes, but telling kind of their story, their life story, their surroundings. And it posed the question for the reader of, you know, if you had grown up in the same environment and you reached the same point in your life, would you be doing anything different? Would you not also turn to crime? And I think it was an uncomfortable read from that point of view, but I think a really, really important one in terms of the realities of South Africa, and extremely well written. And he followed it up more recently with a collection of short stories called Searching for Simpiwe, which is also, you know, sort of filled with crime and cops and set in the same kind of area. So, I mean, I would recommend both of them very, very highly.
I remember from Searching for Simpiwe, there's one character that features in numerous stories. She's a police officer, and she's this very dedicated, working person. And I kind of wished for a full-length novel about her. Maybe
absolutely.
He'll hear this.
Absolutely. I'd love that. Yes.
Actually, Searching for Simpiwe was also recommended by Ompile in the first episode.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So he's getting the love that he deserves, I think.
Absolutely.
What's the next book?
Two books which I'm sort of going to talk about together because they both came out relatively recently in the last couple of months. And they're both written by middle-aged white men like me. First is Hammerman by Mike Nichol, and the other one is The Heist Men by Andrew Brown. They're both extremely well written. They've got everything you want in crime fiction in terms of pace, good characters, sort of encouragement to turn the page. But the interesting thing for me about them is that, you know, historically, I think a lot of people have spoken about or thought about crime fiction as escapist and something that people read to take them out of their lives. I remember, I think it was Ian Rankin years ago when he was at Open Book, talking about crime fiction as the best kind of travel writing. Now, I wouldn't describe either Mike's book or Andrew's book as travel writing, but more a kind of social realism. Mike's mission with his crime fiction is to talk about the dark side of Cape Town and South Africa. So his books are written in a very, very realistic way. For a South African reader, there is nothing escapist about them. Mm. And that is something that I really value without sacrificing the sort of traditional tropes or methodologies of crime fiction, you know, in terms of pace, character, et cetera, et cetera. Mike has also got a very distinctive style, something that I've referred to in the past as a sort of Cape Town noir, a very clipped way of writing, which also I think adds to the pace. And yeah, his stuff is just very, very good. The Heist Men by Andrew Brown, similarly, you don't read this feeling like, oh, this is unrealistic, or as a South African, you don't read it the same way as you would Nordic crime or something like that. It features the return of his detective, Eberard February, from way back. And I'd make two comments here, particular comments about Andrew's novel. The one is that Andrew, apart from being an advocate or attorney, I never know the difference, and a writer, Andrew is a police reservist and has got a wealth of experience of working in the police force, which he brings to his novels, which gives them a real sense of realism, for want of a better word. The other thing that Andrew does is he brings his own ethos, his, I want to call it a social justice mentality, into the books in some very, very small details. And I mean, one example I would give is early on in the book, there's a police officer, and by way of introduction, spends a paragraph on his backstory. And what he does there is he recounts this person working on the killing of Robbie Waterwich and Colleen Williams in the 1980s during the late days of the struggle against apartheid. And these are two activists who, there are many people who feel that justice has not been done for them. They are not remembered. They are not honored. Andrew's writing them in a very, very brief way, I think, is a very conscious acknowledgement of that. It would have been very easy for him to write that backstory and refer to a fictional case, you know, make something up. But so there's these placements in the book, which I think add so much to it.
Yeah, I'm busy reading this now. I'm almost done. Really enjoying it as a crime novel, but also for these other details. Before we move on, I haven't read Hammer Man, but I happen to know that there's a cameo from the Book Lounge. How does the Book Lounge feature?
We have a very small role, but thanks, Mike. A top secret document is left at the counter of the Book Lounge for a sort of intelligence agent to collect. Completely fictional.
And yet plausible.
No comment. It's always nice to surprisingly sort of turn the page halfway through a novel and find the Book Lounge mentioned in however a sort of nefarious way.
Incidentally, I also enjoyed that about Andrew Brown's book is the specificity in which he writes Cape Town, and he's writing about observatory in great detail, and Woodstock in great detail, like neighborhoods that I know very well. And it got to the point where if there was a restaurant I didn't recognize, I put it on a list to go. So it also functions as kind of as a recommendation for restaurants and coffee shops in the area.
Product placement from OBS, yeah.
Okay, what's the next one?
The next one is something quite different to the others in that it's a work of nonfiction. Also, a recent book came out about 2 months ago by Liz McGregor called Unforgiven, Face to Face with My Father's Killer. Liz's father, Robin, was fairly well known. He was, amongst all sorts of other things, the founder of Who Owns Whom, and so spent a lot of time investigating companies on the stock exchange and unraveling those sort of networks of ownership, and did a lot of incredibly important work there. And the book opens with him having just been murdered in his home in Tulbagh, a couple of hundred kilometers from Cape Town. The book has got a couple of different elements to it, and one is a very personal sort of processing of grief that Liz, as his daughter, was faced with, and her attempts to come to terms with the death of her father, who she was close to, and everything that process entails. The second thing, which in a way was part of that process for her, was that she embarked on a journey to try and meet and spend some time with the person who was convicted of her father's murder. And I guess this is, you know, as a means of trying to understand something about her father's last moments and exactly what happened, and something that she felt would aid her process in terms of coming to terms with her father's death. And what that part of the narrative does and where it takes us to is the whole notion of restorative justice, which I found absolutely fascinating. It's probably not too much of a spoiler to say that that was a very frustrating journey for Liz. We are dealing with a situation in this particular case where the man who was convicted of her father's death, despite overwhelming evidence, has refused to admit that he actually murdered Robin McGregor. And that is the kind of first thing that needs to happen for the process of restorative justice to kick in. So it is a long and winding road towards a dead end in this particular case. But Liz's process, I think, opens up all sorts of fascinating and difficult conversations about that and how we deal with people who have been convicted of crimes and what the options are for some kind of restorative justice, as opposed to a punitive or incarceratory justice, but it's an absolutely fascinating read. It's extremely well written.
The writing is exceptional. Mm. It's interesting, so much of the discourse in sort of crime fighting, at least in fiction, is about getting justice for the victims or the families of the victims, but that usually involves leaving the victim out of the process completely. Their preferences or desires are not taken into account at any point in the justice process, normally, if the only option is imprisonment. So restorative justice is an interesting way of bringing the victim's experience back in and giving them a voice and agency in the justice-seeking process. Mm.
Absolutely. And I mean, Liz writes quite movingly about the trial, the court case, and exactly that, describing how this person is on trial for her father's murder and the process of the court case, the process of justice, one which involved the defendant and the state.
She's a spectator only.
There's no place for the victim in that process, which I thought was really, really interesting.
Mm. I'm very interested by your last choice.
Yeah. Caroline David's How to Be a Revolutionary.
Let me just clarify that I'm interested because I love this book.
I love this book as well, as you well know. It's Caroline's second novel. Her first one, Blacks of Cape Town, came out probably about 10, 12 years ago. Maybe if you asked me to talk about anything, I would find a way to wangle How to Be a Revolutionary into it. But I think the reason I decided to include this in this conversation is that I think that notions of genre and categories are, by definition, kind of up for grabs and quite flimsy at times. Mm. You know, if one tries to work out some kind of definition of crime fiction, and surely that means a novel in which there are crimes or there is crime. And if that's the case, then How to Be a Revolutionary definitely fits the bill. It's a novel set in three distinct sort of time and place spaces. One is the late 80s, late apartheid on the Cape Flats of Cape Town, in which our main character joins a student movement and a very good friend of hers slash mentor, also a high school student, is blown up while attempting to plant a bomb outside a police station. This story is based on the same thing that I mentioned in Andrew's book, which is Colleen Williams and Robbie Waterwitch. And again, there's a sense of Caroline putting a story putting two people, rather, who have not received the attention that they deserve in post-apartheid South Africa, writing them into the novel. And there's the first crime, okay? The backdrop is apartheid, which is a crime against humanity. But the reason that they died, or that she died in the novel, is that a apartheid agent tampered with a bomb, which is also a crime, okay? Secondly, the second sort of space of the novel is set a decade or two later, where our main character is now in China working for the South African consulate. So you've got a contemporary Shanghai, a very strong contemporary Shanghai element to the novel. And she befriends an old Chinese man who's her next-door neighbor. Befriends is possibly putting it a bit strongly. It's a very, very odd relationship, but a very nuanced relationship, which Caroline has written quite beautifully. Her neighbor disappears, and a manuscript that he has been working on starts getting delivered, slid underneath her door in parts very mysteriously during the night. And she makes an attempt through somebody else to try and decipher this manuscript. And the story that is contained in there refers to her neighbor's deep history in the 1950s, beginning of the Cultural Revolution in China under Mao, and the desperate criminal, see, there's a crime, or many crimes, things that went on there, and a lot of which in this particular case has to do with the unexplained disappearance of his mother. So the book is set across these different times and spaces, 1950s China, contemporary Shanghai, and our Cape Flats in the 1980s, with a sort of guest appearance from the wonderful American poet Langston Hughes, who's writing letters to a unnamed Cape Town writer, but who is clearly based on Richard Reeve, while Langston Hughes, that is being hauled before the McCarthy Commissions into un-American activities. This is 1950s America, and being accused of being a communist, partially because of his writing, but partially because of his trips to Russia and China. So that kind of links up there. And anybody who doesn't argue that the McCarthy Commissioner McCarthy witch hunts was not a crime, and crime against humanity is off their rocker. So there's all sorts of different kinds of crimes in Carol Ann's absolutely wonderful novel. A lesser writer would really, really have struggled to pull those different strands together. And it is also a book, when I first heard about it, and I thought, okay, this is going to be a kind of 600-page tome. And it's not. She holds these stories together very, very precisely in, I don't know, 240, 250 pages. It's beautifully written and highly recommended whether you're into crime fiction or not.
For sure, I would second that. I think this is maybe my favorite book of the year so far. So this is a book about state repression and like the machinations involved in that. And you're referring to those repressive acts as crimes, but it also is a reminder how crime is used to extend the power of the state to become more repressive, as we see with around Tiananmen Square in China and how it's forbidden to speak about that, and then Lang Xin Yu's being hounded in this way. I don't know if it's by police per se, but you know, the line between persecution and prosecution is blurred.
Absolutely. And just to add to that, I mean, despite the the title How to Be a Revolutionary, I think is quite ironic. Because another theme of the book is about the betrayal of revolutionaries, or betrayal by revolutionaries, and the crimes that are committed in the name of revolution. And there she draws a thread between South Africa and China as well. And the letdown or betrayals of the South African revolution, if I can call it that. It's not the same as what happened in China under Mao, but there are parallels.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Mervyn. These are amazing recommendations. People need to get hold of these books.
Indeed they do. Absolute pleasure. Thanks, Fusty.
Thanks for listening, everyone. This was our final episode for the season, so thanks to everyone who joined me in putting this together. The authors for joining me in conversation, the readers who shared their recommendations, the Book Lounge for their support, our incredible editor, Andre Burnett, and to you, the listeners. This season was made possible by a grant from the National Arts Council. Please do join me at the book club taking place next week so we can connect in person. I've been your host, Fusty Collins. Keep reading.